You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the hysteria is increasing. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It is just going nuts on Capitol Hill. It's like, oh, no. The White House says, you know, if we have to do this sequester, we're going to have to kill off all these or, you know, postpone all these. And the Republicans are going, ah, but you must have austerity. It worked so well in Greece and Spain, after all, don't you know? Although there are some differences between us and Greece and Spain. There is a new school of thought, of economic thought. It's arguably new. John Maynard Keynes kind of made passing reference to what might be its early ancestor in his book on money. It's called Modern Monetary Theory. One of its chief proponents is Dr. Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of the Long-Term Economic Trends, ILET, the author of Trade, Development, and Foreign Debts, and his newest book, The Bubble and Beyond, and his website, michael-hudson.com. Dr. Hudson, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Very glad to have you with us. Modern monetary theory will save the United States from ourselves. Let's start at the beginning. Why is it that deficits don't... Well, first of all, could that be an accurate statement?
No theory can save a country if you have bad administrators. I don't think it would matter what how good a theory there was if you have the banks running things to ignore it. We do say is that the austerity is unnecessary, that deficits are unnecessary to borrow from the banks. You don't have to have budget cuts. You don't have to go back to austerity because all money, whether it's bank money or whether it's government money, all money's created on a computer keyboard electronically now that we don't have a gold standard anymore. In 1971, when the United States was finally forced off gold by its military spending, nobody knew what the future monetary system would be. And it turned out that there wasn't any constraint on how much money could be created. So most money's been created by banks. And they create it when you go into a bank, you take out a loan, and the bank doesn't lend out a deposit. The bank simply writes an electronic credit to your account, and then you get to spend it. And the bank can borrow from the Federal Reserve at 0.25%. So right now, the banks lend to you at money at a high rate of interest, borrowing almost free money from the Fed. The Fed can create money to finance the banks. They can create money to finance the real estate bubble. They can create money for the banks to make gambles. Why can't they make the same money for the government to finance the debts? Well, the banks say, no, no, you have to lend us money and let us finance the government debt at interest. And the government could say, and what we say at Monetary Theory, wait a minute, the job of the central bank is to finance the government debt. Simply like that's how the United States fought the Civil War with greenbacks.
Sure. It's England. But isn't there a... You've raised a whole bunch of things here. First of all, isn't there a law that says that when the federal government issues treasuries, if the that they have to be run through private banks in order for the Fed to buy, somehow there's private banks in between the treasuries and the Fed.
So, for instance, the federal government, after the bailout in 2008, the federal government simply, for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac alone, it just said, okay, we're now adding those to the government balance sheet. We owe now $5.3 trillion. The Federal Reserve created $2 trillion worth of just free credit to give to the banks. Now, the Treasury, most Treasury bills recently are either electronically held by foreign governments in exchange for the balance of payments deficit, or they're held by the Social Security Fund. There's no there's no need at all for central banks to have to borrow from the private banks, either here or in England or Japan, or in any other country with a central bank.
All right. So there's we're sort of getting in the weeds here, but I want to understand this more completely. You're suggesting that the first of all, what am I correct in my belief, my understanding that private banks are somehow somewhere in the process between our Treasury Department and the Fed, our central bank?
Yes.
That the law requires that when the Fed basically invents money and loans it to the United States government by buying treasuries, those have to go through for-profit banks, and those banks make a profit on that transaction.
No profit at all. And there never has been a law like that.
There is not. Okay.
You pointed out before that talking about money and complexity is like going through weeds, and you're right. There are so many complexities that even if you and I can make a very clear statement, if people haven't actually worked in a bank and worked in the field, it's very hard for them to understand these words that you and I are using right now. We have a website for monetary theory at the University of Missouri at Kansas City called New Economic Perspectives. And every day we walk through readers with this kind of tangle of how to go through all of this process. Right. It is hard, and monetary theory attracts a lot of cranks.
Well, I get that. But very simply, just to get the whole central bank thing out of the way and the private bank thing. Really, the essential issue here is that since 71 to 73, when the gold window closed,
71.
Well, it officially started in 71, but in 73 was when it wrapped up, was it not? I think. But let's say 71. I thought it took a couple of years to kind of unwind that, but I may well be wrong.
Nixon stopped it in mid-August.
Yeah. Okay. Of 71. At that point, the only constraint legally on the federal government to create money, or the Fed to create money, which is not the federal government, there was no legal constraint.
It creates money, and it's quasi-government. On the Federal Reserve note, it used to every Federal Reserve note until 1971 was had to be backed by 25% gold.
Right.
So in other words, America's gold reserve backed the physical currency that the Fed does. Now, most money isn't really currency. Most money is bank deposits. But the currency actually was backed by the gold stock. That was what stopped.
Right. The point that I'm making is that one of the arguments that is made is that we could simply, write ourselves a check, basically, or mint a trillion-dollar coin or whatever. I mean, there's a variety of ways to do this. Or just put some numbers in a computer and bring this country to full employment without creating inflation via this process of modern monetary theory.
Is that an accurate statement? Basically, that's right. That's the aim.
And the reason why is because the sole arbiter of what's going on with the nation's currency is the nation. So how did the banks get in this thing? We just have a minute left.
Really, only by lobbying, only by telling, by backing politicians who agree not to use the central bank to help pull the country out of depression, but to use the central bank basically to give money to the commercial banks, to Wall Street. That the money that's been created has not been to employ Americans. It's been employed on the bank bailout.
Right.
It's been employed on the bank giveaways. Now, if the government can create money, bank giveaways, to bail out Wall Street, why not spend money on the real economy and employ people?
That makes perfect sense. Dr. Michael Hudson, president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, the author of Trade Development and Foreign Debt and The Bubble and Beyond, the website michael-hudson.com. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great speaking with you. Thank you. Always a pleasure. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, when we come back from the break, I'm going to begin at the beginning. We're going to lay this whole thing out in a way that's completely understandable. Stick around. Okay, let me break this down and turn this into plain English. I mean, just some really simple stuff. Back in the late 1970s, I was doing business in Japan. Actually, it was the early 1980s. It was 83 through 86. My best friend Jerry Schneiderman and I had started a company called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems, and we were importing anti-radiation screen shields and low radiation picture tubes from Japan. And so my oldest daughter and I went through a class in Japanese. We studied Japanese culture. I spent a lot of time in Japan. I was doing business in Japan. I learned how to count in Japanese. I learned a lot. And one of the things that I learned I wrote a novel called The Sword of Geary, which is to this day unpublished, although Chuck Norris's production company at one point optioned it to make it into a movie, but which never happened. But one of the things that I learned was that Japanese culture is very much like most tribal societies, probably virtually all human societies, at least began. And that is, it's what's called an obligation culture. With Native American societies, we call them a potlatch culture. There is this thing called giri, G-I-R-I. And basically it means obligation. And there are different kinds of giri. When you give somebody a gift, you incur this obligation. Or they incur the obligation when they accept the gift, actually. And now they have to give you back a gift. And people take this very, very seriously in Japan. They very carefully calibrate. They very carefully keep track of what they've received from people so that they can give back to them. And there's this, there's various forms of giri and an and gemu. Of obligation to the emperor, obligation to the state, obligation to your parents, obligation to your employer, obligation to your children and spouse and family, and all these kinds of things. So it all began with obligation. Now, what you and I were taught about money in elementary school was that money started out as a medium of exchange to replace barter. It turns out this is not true. But here's the not true story that we all learned in school, that we all think we know. And that is that way back in history, long ago, I was growing wheat and Shano was growing corn and Jim was raising chickens and Danielle was helping make huts for us to live in. And we all decided that we were going to, we'd meet in the marketplace and I'd need to buy something to repair my hut. And so I'd go to Danielle, but she was building a hut. She didn't need my wheat. She needed instead, something else, And so and I couldn't get that with the wheat, but I could go to Jim and say, hey, Jim, can I get some chickens? Because I know that the guy who's got the stuff that Danielle needs will take a chicken for it. And so we had this barter economy, and it didn't work very efficiently. There's what economists call shoe leather costs associated with it. And so to get rid of those shoe leather costs, what we all did is we agreed on something as a medium of exchange, cowrie shells or wampum beads actually, the oldest city in the world, Corral, in Lima, Peru. I was down there a couple of years ago. We did our show from there. And I saw knots, actual knots, knotted cotton that were money. And so the story goes that these represented something of value and thus could be converted into something of value. And eventually we went from using those or stone tablets or clay tablets or whatever. We went from those to using something that actually had intrinsic value. That would be gold or silver. And then out of that, we created paper currency to represent that. And then we abandoned that in 71. The story is not true. What is true is that in the beginning was society. Now, the reason why it was all about making money as a medium of exchange seems to stick is because it kind of follows the libertarian line that it was all about me trying to figure out how to sell my wheat or Shano trying to figure out how to sell his corn or whatever. I've forgotten what I've assigned to whom. Chickens, yeah, Jim. But it really wasn't about enlightened self-interest or any of this libertarian baloney. Really what it was about was society. We're a tribe. We're a community. We're a family. We're living here in the desert or in the jungle or in the plains or wherever we are, in the city even. We're living here. And there is a cost to running our society. There are things that we have to have in common. The roads, the place where we all get together and sing, the common space, most of it was the commons. And so there has to be a way that we can support ourselves, our society, that we can basically pay our taxes so that those common structures can exist. And the way that we do that is by taking a little piece off the top of commerce. So money was invented by society, by our first governments, our tribes, as a way of making sure that as commerce happened, a little piece of that was supporting the commons. And that's why wampum beads aren't actually money. We completely misunderstood them. What they are is accounting entries. They're the same thing as right now. You know, when you move money from one checking account to another, you don't physically move money. You move ones and zeros and threes and fives and sevens on a computer screen. That's what wampum beads were. It was an accounting of who owed what. It all goes back to Geary. It all goes back to obligation. And the first obligation was the obligation to society. And money was created by society as a vehicle to fulfill that obligation. And then it became used by the private sector, as it were. So the first thing that we have to change is our understanding of money and what it is. And once we understand what money is, and we understand that, you know, the gold standard is irrelevant, or even going back to gold is irrelevant, then a whole bunch of other stuff starts making sense. And I'll get into that after the break of the button.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What is the real reason why Jefferson would say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? A government function? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, here's the really simple thing. We don't need to have unemployment. We don't need to be hysterical about our debt. This whole kabuki theater that's going on around sequestration and all this other stuff is total nonsense. And all of that is true in large part because Nixon took us off the gold standard in 71. Now let's go back to why that's true. Why it's possible that our government could actually make our society work. In fact, that not only are public debts not a bad thing, but they're actually a good thing because they represent surpluses in the private sector. This country, 8 times in its history since George Washington became president, 8 times we've shown a surplus instead of a debt. And each time it was followed by a depression or a severe recession. Why? Double entry bookkeeping. The bigger the private sector surplus, the larger the public sector debt. Government debt equals surplus in the private sector, plus or minus our trade balance, right? Which is a whole. But let me work into this a little more slowly. Remember, I was talking about gemu, this feeling of obligation, this you know how society is based on obligation, the Japanese sense of gemu. Or of Geary, excuse me. Gemu is a very specific type of Geary. We used to have a bird. Our parrot was named Gemu. But the Sword of Geary was the book that I wrote. So if money equals Geary, if money equals obligation, if money was created by society so that society can function, then what does society give us? If we have an obligation, if we have Geary to society, if we have an obligation to society, what is the obligation that society has to us? According to Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness if you don't have a damn job? See, Franklin Roosevelt really, really hooked into this back in the early 40s when he proposed his second Bill of Rights. He said that there should be a right to a job. In fact, in 33, when he started the WPA and the CCC and the New Deal, he made what is one of the three primary tenets of modern monetary theory a reality. And that is that if the private sector cannot fund full employment, if the private sector fails to provide everybody with a job, then it's the obligation of government to do so, even if it has to go into debt to do it. In fact, particularly when it goes into debt to do it, because as I mentioned before, as government debt goes up, private surpluses go up. So, but again, that sounds confusing. So let me just make it really simple. The job of government should be to provide full employment. And we could do it now. All we'd have to do is say, you know, we're going to create, we have $2.5 trillion worth of infrastructure that needs to be repaired. For another $1 trillion, we could build a national high-speed rail system. For a fraction of $1 trillion, we could have a broadband system in this country that would be almost as good as that in South Korea or Japan. So why not just have the government write a check and do it? Oh, but that means we'll go into debt. Yes. We've always been in debt. We start in the Revolutionary War. We've always been in debt. Government debt is private savings. It's private surplus. Oh, but what if the Chinese won't buy our debt? Then they don't have to. What if they want their money back? Give it to them. But won't we run out of money? No, we issue the money. The amount of money that the United States has does not depend on how much gold is in Fort Knox. We're not on the gold standard. Are you following this? But wait a minute, if government just creates money out of thin air, then the currency will become worthless, won't it? Won't you have inflation? Only if you go insane. Well, isn't that what happened in Zimbabwe or in the Weimar Republic? No. Isn't that what happened during the Carter years of the inflation? No. Inflation is very rarely about there being too much currency. That has to do with, you know, maybe the value of the currency. I mean, I was in Israel when they changed the shekel, and I have someplace around the house. Actually, they're probably in storage someplace now that we're living in this little boat. I used to have the old Israeli shekels, and you could turn them in for the new shekels. In fact, you had to. And a 100-shekel note became a 10-shekel note. They just knocked a zero off everything. I think it was 1 zero. It might have been 2 zeros. When I used to carry a wallet, I no longer do, but in my wallet, which I know is at home, I've got an old Russian 100-ruble note. And it's just a little thing because it was worth about 15 cents. And it was issued before they issued the new ruble notes. Because I was in Russia when that transition happened. I was in Russia, you know, in fact, I was there the week of the election when Boris Yeltsin, the very first election in 1,000 years in Russian history. I've told you that story on the air before. But anyhow, the whole point is those changes in currency had nothing to do with the government spending too much or there being too much debt. You say, well, what about Spain and Greece? I mean, you know, their debts are exploding. Well, yes, they should be. There's a recession going on. When there's a recession, tax collections go down because people don't have jobs anymore. They're not paying taxes. And the automatic stabilizers kick in. That is, the government starts paying unemployment benefits and covering the costs of things that people used to be able to pay for themselves, like food and medical care. And so government spending goes up, tax collection goes down. You have a deficit, like we have right now in the United States. Now, why is it that Greece and Spain are having to pay 20, 25, 30% or close to it to borrow money to finance their debt, and we're able to sell our debt for nothing, for 1%. The reason why is because we will never run out of dollars. We issue them. Spain and Greece gave up their ability to issue their own currency when they joined the euro. It's like Mississippi. Mississippi is chronically in deficit. Without transfers of wealth from all the rest of us to Mississippi every year for the last probably 50 years, 100 years, God only knows how long. Certainly since the New Deal. And it's not just Mississippi. Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, West Virginia, basically the red states. Without us giving them money, they'd be in deep doo-doo. They'd be like Greece or Spain. But we do it because we're all one country. Well, when they put together the European Union, they didn't realize that. They didn't think of that. This is why the EU is going down in flames. This is why Greece and Spain, because Greece and Spain have the same problem that would happen if West Virginia or Mississippi tried to go out and borrow money with their, you know, and our federal government said, you cannot have, you cannot borrow beyond a certain amount, and we're not going to give you any. So we just give them the money. We don't loan it to them. We feed their people with food stamps. We heal their people with Medicare. We don't ask them to pay us back. You getting this? This is how the United States is different from the European Union, and why the European Union is doomed to fail and the euro is doomed to collapse. And why in the United States, if we were to say, you know, we have basically an infinite supply of dollars. Now, it's not genuinely infinite. It's constrained by a number of things. It's constrained by inflation. It's constrained by demand. There are a number of variables that limit our ability to produce these dollars. But we could literally just say, we're going to put everybody to work. We're going to build that infrastructure. And if you want to, you know, I mean, we could just create the money. You say, well, you can't do that. You can't just create. Actually, you know, we created $29 trillion in the first couple of years, the last couple of years of the Bush administration, the first couple of years of the Obama administration. The Fed created almost $30 trillion. That's half the world GDP. Just to give to banksters. We created it out of thin air. Did it create inflation? No. So what creates inflation? Why did we have inflation during the Carter and Reagan presidencies? Because of the oil price shock. As the price of oil went up, we're so dependent on oil. I mean, literally our food is oil. Our products, everything is oil. So prices went up. So what happened in Zimbabwe? Same deal. In Zimbabwe, when Mugabe took down the white farmers, basically, and turned the land over to anybody who wanted it, as long as they weren't white farmers, the people who took over the land didn't know how to farm. And so there was a food shortage. You got a shortage of an essential commodity. What do you have? More demand. Inflation. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In other words, this hysteria that if we use government debt or government money to recover our economy, we'll have inflation, is stupid and wrong. Okay, I am just beginning to scratch the surface on this, and there's all kinds of pieces and subtleties to it. Of modern monetary theory, and I do not represent myself as any kind of even close to expert on it. I am just learning about it myself as time goes on. But I'm trying to lay this out in a fairly straightforward fashion. Let's pick up some calls here. Russ in Basalt, Colorado. Hey, Russ.
Hey, you Tom. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You wanted to disagree with me.
I do a little bit here. I'm actually writing a book on inflation. I'm a financial advisor, an economist, and have an engineering degree. As I understand your argument, that basically there's a free lunch, that we can print money and it has virtually no effect on our economy?
No.
Or let's say
first of all, we don't print money. We create zeros
on
computers.
And
secondly, no, I didn't say that it's unconstrained. I said it's unconstrained by law, but it's not unconstrained by natural laws.
Right. Well, here are the numbers as I understand them. In the last 4 years, we have created, out of thin air essentially, $7 trillion new dollars. As a result of that, I'm sure you understand this, but maybe your listeners don't. The inflation formula has changed three times since 1982. If we were using the 1982 formula, inflation today would be at 13.6%.
Right, and that's because the formulas don't work, Russ. What you're missing is that you're operating on an assumption that there is an intrinsic underlying value to that money that is diluted by producing more money.
Yeah,
and that's a false assumption.
I disagree. Hold on a second.
Let me explain, if I may.
The commodity price index is up from 101 to 182 in the last 4 years.
Let me explain, if I may. The underlying intrinsic value of the money of a sovereign nation that is not on a metal standard, that is creating fiat currency, which is us, and is also pretty much all the other developed worlds who are countries in the world who are not part of the Eurozone. The intrinsic value of that is the strength of the society itself. So if the government were to spend, if we were to create money and spend money in a way that strengthens our nation, that builds our nation, in other words, build our infrastructure, put our people to work, then there is no inflationary impact because the ratio of dollars circulating to value of the society maintains itself. And if you want the proof of that, just go all the way back to 1933. Did FDR create inflation? Did Eisenhower create inflation?
The opposite. No.
But see, you're thinking that the government is run like a household or a business, and it's not.
How do you account for commodity prices being up 78% over the last 48 months? And
it depends on the commodity.
There
are a lot of commodity prices that are down right now.
The commodity price index, that's cattle and hogs and cotton and metals and a couple of dozen different commodities. So in other words, a broad index, the commodity price index, is up 78% in the last 4 years, which directly impacts people's disposable income.
I don't disagree with you at all, Russ, and my guess would be that most of that has to do with the increase in the price of oil.
No, it does not, actually. There are other gold is in there, for example. Gold is up, 88%, something like that.
Cattle
prices are up dramatically. It's across the board. I think you should look at it. The commodity price index.
Oil is driving everything.
Oil is a part of it. Oil is up maybe, 120%, I think.
But those prices are not, we're not seeing those as generalized inflation. Inflation is the consequence of the demand for something exceeding the supply of it. So people start bidding it up.
Well, I would disagree with that. I would disagree with that completely.
People are bidding it up, Russ.
Don't you think that currency should be a storage of value? And I have a really simple explanation of what I'm trying to say.
Are a store of cultural value, of societal value.
Okay. Well, see, I disagree. I used to shovel driveways when I was a kid. I'm sure most kids did. You know, I lived back east. And in 1968, I was shoveling driveways, little suburban driveways, for about $1 a piece. It took me about 20 minutes, 25 minutes to do so.
Did you issue those dollars?
I'm sorry?
Did you issue those dollars?
No, but there,
so
there
then, was, you, then your argument
what would
falls
I have to pay, if I could find someone to shovel my driveway today, some kid, what would I have to pay him today?
It would be a lot more. There's the inflation has eroded the value of our currency,
exactly.
But that has been the decision of our government because we've been operating on the assumption we're in this weird hybrid right now, Russ, where we're operating as if we're on the gold standard. We've been behaving like we're on the gold standard ever since Nixon took us off the gold standard when we don't have to. And the consequence of that has been the
Tom, commodity prices to me are the truest measure of inflation because that's what we have to pay for gas.
No,
we have to pay for food. What we have to pay for clothing. What we have to pay for construction costs. And to me, that is the truest measure of inflation.
And what we are paid
right
in salaries. But no, well, okay, we're mixing terms up. You're calling an increased demand for and therefore an increased price of goods inflation, and I'm calling a depreciation of the value of currency inflation.
That is what I'm calling it too, a depreciation in the value of the currency. I mean, the official number since 1970 is the currency has lost 82% of its value.
Right, and I'm saying that the reason why our currency is losing its value and the reason why the Fed thinks it needs to regulate this is because we're operating on this mindset that we're not a sovereign nation creating our own currency, that instead somehow our currency has a value relative to, in this case, commodity prices. And I would suggest to you that it shouldn't. It doesn't need to.
If we doubled the number of dollars outstanding tonight, let's say,
as the Chinese did,
and let's say the Saudis are selling us our oil, which mostly they don't, but let's just use that as an example. And I forget what the exchange rate is for the real right now. But if we doubled the amount of currency, the amount of dollars outstanding,
Russ, we created 29
of a barrel of oil.
We created the first day after the Bush crash, we created $1 trillion. Where's the inflation from that? In the first 2 years after that, we created $29 trillion. Where's the inflation from that?
I didn't hear what you said.
I said we created $29 trillion. The Fed created $29 trillion out of thin air.
Well, what I'm trying to get across, Tom, is that to me, a currency should be a storage of value. And by increasing the amount of currency,
currency no longer reflects the size or growth of society. It reflects some other underlying thing, in this case, commodities. And that just won't work.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Greg Marad is on the line with us. He's the Vice President of the National Right to Work Committee. NRTWC.org is the website. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to join you.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah, Rand Paul has talked about introducing a national Right to Work for Less law. We've seen Right to Work for Less basically shoved down the throats of people in Michigan and Indiana, Wisconsin. It's a growing trend and has been since Taft-Hartley in 47. What I don't get is why would you be out there dancing to the tune of the billionaires instead of the workers?
Well, I certainly would have to begin by objecting to your characterization of it as Right to Work for Less. Right to work is simply...
Well, that's what it is. Right to work for less states.
Whether or not you think a union deserves your support.
Right to... Well, actually, nobody in this country has to join a union, number one. And number two, right to work for less states, people earn on average $1,500 a year less than in free bargaining states.
Do they think the union deserves their support or not?
I couldn't hear you, Greg. I was speaking.
Yeah, I said, Tom, that
did you hear what I said?
I did not make the assertion that anybody is required to join. I simply said that right to work laws.
Okay, so we have established
whether or not a union deserves their support.
So we've established that nobody in this country is required to join a union. And let's also establish for the record that people in right to work for less states earn $1,500 a year on average less than people in free bargaining states.
Before you account for the cost of living, it is significantly more expensive to live in the non-right to work state.
Free bargaining
after
states.
You account for the cost of living, you find that the average family's purchasing power is actually significantly higher in the right to work states.
Greg, the essence of the right to work for less laws is that if you work in a shop that is unionized, whether it's like me, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, although I don't work in a shop, I own my own show. But if I did, and I have in the past. If you're a member of a union, you work in a unionized shop, the union is forced by law to represent me.
Not true.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not, Tom. The union has what's under federal law is called, it has the privilege that's called exclusive representation. That is, they can assert their power to represent workers who would rather be independent. Now, once they have done that, once they have claimed exclusive representation power, then they are forced to represent everybody.
But they wouldn't
right to represent themselves.
But if they don't do that, they can't represent anybody. I mean, there's no point in it being a union if you don't say I'm here to represent people.
Excuse me?
There's no point in it being a union if you don't say, I'm here to represent people.
They're free to say, we're here to represent the people that want us. We'll represent our members only. They are perfectly free to do that. They just don't want to because they have a lot more power at the bargaining table when everybody is stuck with their deal.
The union, no, this is not very much not the case. Unions are required to, if I work in a union shop and I choose not to be a member of the union, but simply to pay for basic union services like representation, I can sue the union if they fail to represent me.
That's true, because they have taken away your right to represent yourself. You do not have the option of bargaining for yourself, of saying, you know what, never mind their contract. I think I can do better on my own.
Right. Yeah. Me versus the Walton family. Yeah, I'm going to do really well.
Well, you know, you might and you might not. And if you try on your own and you do poorly, you might come begging back to the union. But my point is that the union has taken away that right to represent yourself and instead says you have to adjust.
No, you are forcing people. You are the individual people who are working in the union shop. Here's where I was going with this. If I show up at the private club that you're a member of, whether it's a golf course or a, you know, whatever it may be, let's say you're a member of a golf club and a country club. And I show up and I say, nice place you got here. I think I'll have a sip of that champagne and I'll sit in this chair for a while. But by the way, I don't want to pay because this is a right to country club state.
But
what would you say?
Your analogy is false because the individual does not have the option to say, you know what, I don't want your contract.
No, we started out by saying you don't have to be a member of a union.
No, but I'm not talking about membership in the union. I'm talking about the union contract. If you work there, you're stuck with that union contract, even if you think you could do better on your own.
In a free bargaining state.
Longer hours. Maybe you're smarter. Maybe you work harder. Maybe you could do better. Maybe.
You
don't have the option of trying.
So are you really trying to tell me, Greg, that your entire argument after, I mean, you know, we've been watching this go on since 1947. Your entire argument is based on maybe?
My entire argument, Tom, is based on choice. The individual should be free to choose whether or not they think a union is serving their interests.
And I'm saying, hey, I should be free to choose. No, you're not saying that. What you're saying is the individual should be free to choose whether or not they're going to pay union dues.
No.
Whether they're going to pay
I'm saying,
you
know, look, Tom, I would love for them to be free to choose to skip out of the union contract too and cut their own deal.
But your point of all right to work for less legislation is to destroy. I'll interrupt you halfway through. Your point is to destroy the unions, and this is what happens
in state after state
to destroy the unions by saying to the workers, you don't have to pay into the fee if you don't want to. You don't have to pay for the services if you don't want to. But you at the same time say to the union, if you fail to provide those services, this employee can sue you and win.
What I say to the unions is you shouldn't represent those people. Give up exclusive representation. Represent only your members, and then you will not have a
union. Then you don't have a union anymore.
Write a contract.
That's not a union.
Yes, it is.
That's a tiny association.
That's
a club.
People don't think it serves their interests.
That's not a union. That's a club. You're saying you can. Oh, yeah, you're welcome to turn your union into a club. You know, let's get all the guys who like to play pool together on Saturday night. But a union represents the workers against management or with management or to management.
Prior to the Wagner Act in 1935, all unionism was voluntary.
I know, and that's why the Rockefeller family was murdering people.
They did not force people to join and to accept their contract prior to 35, and even for years after 35, voluntary union membership and members only bargaining was very, very common. Now, as unions realized the power that having a monopoly on the labor force gives them, they have gradually given up that model. Though even today, you will find some unions arguing when it suits their advantages in court that this is a perfect.
Greg, are you going to assert that prior to the Wagner Act, that employers were not murdering people for trying to unionize workers?
I'm confident that happened, and unions, frankly, have murdered and brutalized people to force them in.
Name one.
There's bad actors on
Name
both
one.
Sides of this.
Name one.
Name one. Eddie York.
Ludlow Massacre. I see your one. I up you 120.
A strike.
the Ludlow massacre.
I'm not going to argue.
Rockefellers came in and burned out families.
There have been
killed children as they ran through the night.
There have been bad actors on both sides. That's not.
And you want to take us back to those days? I don't get it.
I don't want to go back to those days.
You want to go back to a situation? What right to work for less laws do is they take us back to a situation where the billionaires hold all the cards, and you, one guy, you, Greg, all by yourself. Good luck negotiating with me, the billionaire, because I'm just not going to take your terms.
Well, if I do that poorly, then I'll come back to the union and say, you know what? Here's my dues. I want to be a member.
But by that point, the laws have been changed. The Wagner Act has been eviscerated. There is no legal basis for the union to say to the employer, we actually represent these people and you have to pay attention to us, because people like you, the right to work for less people, have destroyed that ability of workers to organize themselves into unions.
Not at all. Right to work makes for stronger unions because
not true.
Union leadership is forced to be accountable.
Please name one state where right to work for less legislation has been passed and that state saw more unions.
Nevada.
Saw an increase in. Oh, that's because their population went up on a per capita basis.
I don't have those figures in front of me.
Well, that's because they don't exist. Nevada grew, of course, because the casinos grew and many of them are unionized. But
have chosen not to be part of a union, it's because they don't think a union has served their interests. If they feel the need of a union, they'll join one.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We will leave Greg with the last words on that. Greg Murad, NRTWC.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lydia in Tehachapi, California. Am I saying that right, Lydia?
Yeah, pretty close.
Oh,
Tehachapi.
Wow.
Land of the acorn.
Oh, okay. So what's up? I
am constantly impressed by your even tone, despite the obnoxious speaker who was trying to defend his right to work for less legislation.
Yeah, well, I did shut him down more than once, I think.
Yeah, but you know what? I would be madder and screaming at him just like he began screaming as well. I mean, he's appealing to sheer opportunism, like the Ayn Rands of the world, who think that it's okay to screw your fellow man in order to get whatever you can without regards to the consequences for other people.
Well, really what he's arguing for is disempowered workers.
Yeah.
And
don't disagree.
That was his closing statement, was everybody should have the right to choose whether or not to be in a union.
I found it humorous because you're saying that that creating a union was taking the rights of workers to negotiate their own deals. And as a longstanding union activist in the shop and as a representative, I can tell you that that's not the case. I know of opportunists who have said that they could do a better job than the union rep, and they try to negotiate their deal. And there's a duplicitous nature of employers. And they'll say when it's convenient, they will try and make a deal, and then you catch them on it, because what the union does is continuously document. A good union has a system to document how the functioning of a shop is operating, or whatever the circumstances, whether it's an office, whether it's a union shop, and it establishes standards so that it is fair to all. It's like the Ledbetter Act. It's not acceptable within a union to discriminate against women, although it does exist and they justify it, but a good union can turn those circumstances and begin leveling off so that it's based on your skill or your ability and your training to get your wage at a level that is commensurate to whatever you're doing, the dangers of your work.
Right.
And I think that because many workers have in the early 30s lost fear of the attacks and the violence, and they learn to successfully communicate with workers from other cultures and in other languages, that the Wagner Act was finally established because employers realized that they needed to have stability and to get production. And
right, and there was actually, a period of a couple of decades there where, up until 47, arguably up until, you know, the early 50s, which was the peak of unionization, where employers saw unions as partners. And
reluctantly, for the most part, and then they began to allow the work. The stability of a workforce is critical to production.
Yeah.
But we're getting to a point where we have irrational employers, and I've had the experience of employers trying to maneuver and create division between workers. And you know, if a worker goes into a shop and tries to make his own deal, and if the employer wants to screw with the union, they'll say, "Oh, I can't give you what you." What you asking because the union says this, that, or the other.
Right. Or they'll say, "Oh, yeah, I would give you a much better deal if it wasn't for the union."
Yeah. And so you're getting this duplicitous nature. Yeah. Since the late 70s when we started to see the uprise of law firms that were merging with psychological organizations in order to really screw with workers. Collecting information and showing where the connections, familial connections, which is oftentimes the case, especially in factories that have families or long-standing histories of families, like the little small town that I live in, where there's several generations who continue to work in the factory, and it's a good, stable-paying job, but, you know, people understand that there are rules that they have to follow, and as long as they get their production out, in a timely manner, there's relative harmony.
Yeah, I well said. Thank you, Lydia. I appreciate the call and excellent point. Sean in Lansing, Illinois. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great.
Hey, Tom, I just want to say, first of all, man, you are amazing, man, in terms of your knowledge and information that you're sharing with the audience.
Well, I occasionally run up against my own limitations. What do you want to talk about, though, Sean?
Well,
thank you for your kind words.
I consider you one of the most intelligent people on radio, honestly.
Thank you.
However, you were just talking about the monetary system.
Yeah.
And how that all of the inner workings of that. My question is, why aren't our politicians doing exactly, well, why isn't our media going out and giving the information as to inform the electorate on what's really what, you know, when you talk about the sequestration and all of that.
Yeah. It's because people don't understand this. People don't understand. First of all, you've got, you know, hundreds of years of economic theory that turns out was wrong. And you've got this whole history of money that we were all taught in elementary school about, you know, seashells and all, you know, where money came from, that was wrong. And a lot of it is grounded in just, you know, bad information. A lot of it is grounded in kind of a libertarian worldview, a big R Republican worldview that money came about as a consequence of people wanting to barter in the marketplace and looking for more efficient ways to do it, rather than the actual historical, demonstrable history of money, which is that money came about because people organized themselves into societies, and the society had to have a way to basically fund itself and, you know, to take something off the top. And so it had to create, and so it created a stable medium of exchange that was used by everybody. So the media doesn't understand this, and I'd say 95% of our politicians don't understand this. And that's why they're doing this insane dance around things like, you know, the deficit ceiling, which arguably made sense back when we were on the gold standard, because you didn't want to depreciate relative to our gold. We're not on the gold standard anymore. Sean, thank you for the call. It's going to take some time, and I'm going to keep talking about this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm actually really excited and really enthusiastic, because this concept of the modern monetary theory, I think, can help this country so much. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. That's far more than 15 seconds. You know, these are 15s, right? Yeah, so we're doing 15. Welcome back. Pleased to have you with us. And Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
It's Lamarck, but that's okay.
Lamarck, thank you.
OMG. Man, after hearing Russ from Oregon and your guest, Mr. More Rad, what an appropriate name. I think you need to introduce those two to Manfred Max Neef, the Chilean economist.
Yeah.
And Richard Wolff, the hornless Marxist.
Okay.
I think that would help a whole lot. I almost forgot the original reason I called. My original reason was I have a question about the Japanese idea of keeping track of their personal and personal obligations that you mentioned at the top of the show.
Yes, giri.
Yeah. Is this something that's rooted in ancient Japanese culture, or
yes.
did it emerge after the Western contact in the early 19th century? Is it
no.
a result of our contamination of their culture? Do you know?
No, it's the other way around. This goes back centuries, millennia. This goes back millennia, thousands of years. And this is very, very common in stable societies, in societies where people have to figure out how to live with each other because they're going to be in the same place for a long, long time, agricultural societies in particular. Very common.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with our notion of Christmas
no.
gift-giving and all.
No, our Christmas gift-giving and...
I was sad to hear.
Go ahead.
Sir?
What I was going to say
one
is...
level, my first reaction when you described that is it kind of saddened me because I thought about how we've been assaulting their culture, you know, for the past, 100-plus years.
Sure.
And I thought about, on one level, how that reminded me of what we do on Christmas time. We pervert this idea of gift-giving to the point where we have this internal tally, and it seems almost contrary to the spirit of gift-giving around Christmas time. So that's why I had that
yeah.
question. But
I plan
to have Manfred Max Nephon as a guest sometime soon, along with Richard Wolff.
Yeah, Richard Wolff is a regular on the show, and Manfred I'll have to check out. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Gift-giving at Christmas is arguably... a variation on, or at least keeping track of, you know, who did I get a card from this year and who do I have to send one to and who did I get a gift from and who, that kind of thing is, it's wired into us. This idea of a societal obligation, this is wired into us. And this is how money came about. You know, very simply, very straightforward. So. Oh, this is interesting. We've got a whole bunch of conversations here about right to work. Ike in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah, Tom, I've been listening for a long time. This is the first time I've been able to call you or get a hold of you, and I'll tell you something straight up, and this might get a little emotional because my mother died serving the Union. I've got my great uncle that got his head busted in front of the Rouge and died in the street in front of the Ford Rouge plant.
Whoa.
Listen, people, this guy that was just on the air, let me tell you something that these people get that we don't get. They get the benefits of the union wage and the union work rules and everything else, all our protections. And then on top of that, he's wrong. You're right. My mother was a business agent. We had to. We absolutely had to represent them people when they had agreements, whether they paid dues or not. So he's a liar. And beyond that, I'll tell you something, brother. If workers in this country don't wake up and they don't understand that if you've got no juice, you've got no power, and the only power you've got is standing together, I got news for you, brother. You're going to go down the road that I go. And you know where I'm living? I'm living in South Carolina, right to work, and in my construction jobs, just so you know, after 30 years of painting, after a four-year apprenticeship, three nights a week, and all the things I've done, I've worked at Cape Canaveral, I've served my country, I'm a patriot, etc., 32 years, I quit painting, I'm done with construction. You know why? Because there's no laws. It's like the wild, wild west. They can use illegals. They can pay people cash under the table. They subvert the 1099 subcontract rules, and they pay you cash to where you've got to pay your own taxes. They don't pay you enough to start with. You know,
it's all because it's a right to work for less state.
Tom, you told the truth. And the man that you had on the air, he's a liar, straight up. Front. He's a liar, and if workers don't wake up, you're not going to have a post office. You ain't going to have no public schools. You keep going down this road, and by the way, you can work like I work is for nothing.
Yeah, and this is what happens in state after state when right to work for less comes into the state, is that the number of union jobs relative to all the other jobs starts to decline. The percentage of union membership begins to decline. And it does because organized money will kick the crap out of organized labor if organized labor is not able to organize. And to be able to organize and stand up against organized money requires some backup from the state. That's one of the jobs of the state. Thank you very much. Very well said, Ike. I appreciate the call. Joe, you want to take the other side of that argument. Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Yeah, thanks. 2 points. One is, you know, we're not in a Slaughterhouse Five world anymore, and we're not, you know, this isn't the 1910s or the 20s or the 30s or even the 40s.
No, but we're heading that way.
You think so, but...
look around you.
Look
around you. One in five children in America right now is living in poverty. One in 20 children in the last 2 years went to sleep hungry in the United States. In the United States! You got 40 million people who have no access to health insurance. You got 45,000 people who died last year because they didn't have access to health insurance. In the United States! The richest nation on earth. Yes, we are absolutely going back to where we were before we had unions, before we had FDR.
That has nothing to do with right-to-work laws.
It absolutely has everything to do with them.
The sole purpose of a union is to exclude labor from its market.
Not true. The sole purpose of a union is to bargain on behalf of organized labor with organized capital.
No, it's not. I'll give you several examples. I lived them firsthand. I have proudly crossed three or four picket lines in my life, and some of the proudest days when I was in college, working my way through college. The unions went on strike in my university.
Joe, I get it that you're proud of being a scab. How do you think that it's a good thing?
I grew up in poverty.
Joe, I get it that you're proud of being a guy who grew up in poverty and was a scab. But answer this question. How are you going to balance the power of organized money all by yourself? Or are you simply going to show up and beg for a job like you've done in the past?
Let me give you another example. My father grew up in the Depression, used to go to the city every winter to try to work.
You don't have an answer to my question, do you, Joe?
I asked the question again. What was it?
How do workers balance the power of organized money if they don't have the power to organize themselves?
Very easy. Be a good worker.
Oh, Joe, I'm sorry. You know, if that's all you got, see you later. Alan in Cartersville, Illinois. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Oh, I'll tell you, son of many like the gentleman before, Joe the Scab there. Many union members, boy, your topics today have hit right on the working class. When are American people not going to see it's basically us against them, the working Americans against the elite corporatocracy?
And they declared war on us first, by the way.
They're the ones that set up the banking systems. They're the ones we have to go through for that. And then what really gets me is I don't understand the common worker man like myself. I belong to a union. I've belonged to three different unions. One was shut down by Reagan, like air traffic controllers, the Seafarers Union. He put that out of business when he allowed the rich American shipping tycoons to reflag their ships to foreign flags so they didn't have to follow Coast Guard safety rules, didn't have to hire highly trained American sailors. A short time afterwards in a trade paper, we read about the Russian Russian cruise ship that had been formerly American flagged off the coast of Alaska. The crew went to the lifeboats first when the thing caught fire because they didn't have union trained people on board.
Yep.
Our crew wouldn't have done that.
Yep.
You end up with a group of people in America that, like myself, we're middle class. Between lower and upper middle class, you work, you and your wife both, there's no such thing as a single income family anymore.
Yep.
And you have these same people, my peers in their country, saying, well, right to work allows people to stay in business. They don't understand why factory workers wouldn't go back in for $12 an hour when they were just wanting to cut from 14. I said, you know, they can be on welfare and do the same. I said, the right to work state, you have more people that are employed that don't have health care. You're still paying.
No, you're absolutely right. Alan, you're absolutely right. And where these guys, and thank you for the call, where these guys won the war is when they got everybody to start using the phrase right to work. Because it's right to work for less. It's like, oh, like a right to choose. It's like something. The word right means that it's a positive thing, right? No. Right to work means right to work for less. Let's call it what it is, and let's call it that every single time we say it. It's the right to work for less money. To quote the President of the United States, Barack Obama, the right to work for less money. And frankly, the right to work for fewer benefits, the right to work for less, you name it. It's like if you are in an organization that is large enough that you cannot directly negotiate your own deal with your own employer. You know, basically, small companies, I have a small company. I don't know. Shane and Jim, you guys want to create a union? It's like, we could do it, but, you know, well, there's going to be three of us. So. But it's like, what are we, but if you're looking at Walmart, if you're looking at Olive Garden, if you're looking at, you know, Darden restaurants, and you don't have the power of organized labor, you're toast.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Studs Terkel. Oh, somebody want? I interviewed Studs Terkel back when he was alive. We'll be right back. Check in with the news here with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. And I just clicked the wrong button. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where for this Valentine's Day, one can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. This is Ellen Ratner's own little charity. There's not a lot of overhead with it or anything like that. I mean, this is just one of the coolest little things. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Hey, Victoria, thanks for being with us
today.
Hey,
Tom. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you are well.
I'm very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
So what's going on in the world? Do the Republicans yet have an alternative to the sequester budget to propose?
Well, no, not exactly. And apparently, House Republicans don't have any plans to introduce anything in the next few weeks, according to an article in Politico. And I think part of that is because the last time that they passed anything along these lines, it was pretty close. And they really needed some Democratic votes in order to do it. And they have a reduced majority now, and they wouldn't get the Democratic votes to help them if it was just cuts. And I don't think they can pass what they want to pass, so I don't think they're going to bring it up.
Well, not only that, I think that, you know, the election kind of sensitized people to the fact that the Republicans keep passing budgets that private, you know, that voucherize Medicare and that, you know, put us on the road to austerity, basically. And they're not happy with it.
Well, there's so that.
Do you think there might be a political piece to this, that they're just, it's not so much that they can't pass it, but that they just don't want to be public about their agenda, so they're going to do nothing and blame it all on the president?
Well, there's that piece of it, too. I mean, I think that there's more than one think,
sure,
if you like,
I'm sure
among
you're right.
House Republicans. I think there's what leadership might want, and I think that there's what some of the more conservative rank and file might want.
Right. Okay. A couple of quick questions. Is it true that Inhofe might try to actually filibuster Chuck Hagel, and if so, might that be the thing that would push Harry Reid over the edge with regard to the Senate rules? Has Harry Reid yet finished the first day?
Yes, the first day, I believe, is over. And he does plan to bring it to a vote, the Chuck Hagel. And Jim Inhofe has told National Review Online that he plans to postpone the confirmation of Chuck Hagel. I'll do that for as long as it takes. I'm going to make sure there is a 60-vote margin. He said it's going to be a long, long time before he hits the floor. We're going to need as much time as possible, and there are going to be several of us who will have holds. And he's also made it clear to National Review Online that it was never about getting additional financial information, as 25-plus Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, wrote to Hagel last week asking for 5 years of financial information that Hagel didn't have access to. It's not about that, Jim Inhofe says. It's about Israel. It was always about Israel and what Hagel says are Inhofe says are Hagel's anti-Israel views.
Yeah, their rationale changes from day to day, but what it's really about is trying to wound the president.
It's about wounding the president, using Hagel to do it. There is a new YouTube video that the Weekly Standard is peddling that came out from Israel Nation News, which purports to show Hagel criticizing Israel over nuclear weapons and if you watch this, and if particularly if you read the transcript, I think you would find that you probably agree with everything that Hegel actually says. He actually makes some extremely thoughtful views known on the question of the Middle East peace process, and there's really nothing offensive there. I haven't looked at the Screaming Drudge Report headline. I imagine there is one. If it's taken completely out of context, I suppose somebody could make something of it. But it would be very difficult to even take what he says out of context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, indeed.
And make it out
actually,
of context,
the The top Screaming Drudge headline right now is about the Pope resigning. Do you think that there's any chance, have you heard anything about maybe we can get a more liberal Pope?
Well, apparently it's a three-way race at the moment, there are, according to the bookies. There are three cardinals in the running, but I don't know that any of them are particularly liberal. At least one of them is a non-European, and I think wise money is on a non-European.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure for even a South American, perhaps.
Right, right. South America or Africa. That's where the money's where the money is saying that you should put your bets for a pope. But I don't think that they're looking more liberal. I think they would like a pope who doesn't necessarily say that Islam is, you know, evil.
Right, right. Very interesting. Okay, what else is going on?
Well, the Violence Against Women Act is up in the Senate, and they're probably going to vote on that either late this afternoon or tomorrow.
That's going to pass easily in the Senate, but what's going to happen in the House?
Well, that's the question, and Heritage Action and Freedom Works, two well-financed right-wing activist groups, are trying to put a lot of pressure on conservative Republicans to vote against it, saying that basically it is anti-man, and that it's unnecessary and it's far too expensive. And
it's anti-man to say you can't beat up women?
Under VAWA, men effectively lose their constitutional rights to due process, presumption of innocence, equal treatment under the law, the right to a fair trial. Freedom Works says that a man that raises his voice at his partner, calls her an offensive name, stalks her, causes her any emotional distress, or simply just annoys her, can potentially be prosecuted under the VAWA.
Oh, my. We've had the Violence Against Women Act.
Is rubbish.
Yeah, well, not only that, it's been law for, what, decades already?
Yes, this has not changed. The big change in this is really that the sticking point is the expansion of protection to Native American women on tribal lands against domestic violence by non-Native American partners.
Right, and gays.
And gays, but that's not the big sticking point on which conservative Republicans and other Republicans are hanging their constitutional hat.
Why are conservative Republicans opposed to Native American women having the right of protection?
They claim that they're not, but they say that it's unconstitutional because you're messing with Indian land.
So this is the new excuse.
That is it.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the federal government, let me get back to this modern monetary theory stuff, or at least some little bit of it. And then, you know, we'll there's actually a lot going on out in the world right now. And with the Pope, I asked Victoria. In fact, let me just wander off into this for a second. I'll come back to modern monetary theory. This is the first pope to leave the papacy since 1415. That was Gregory the 12th. But he's in fairly poor health and quite frail. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation that the reason that Benedict is stepping down is because the Easter holidays are coming, and that's a pretty grueling mass for a pope, and the idea of him not being able to make it through just, like, you know, wouldn't be good for the church sort of thing. which actually makes a lot of sense. And it's essentially what he's said. He has, as they point out at the Center, Igor Volsky over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog, this pope, as much as he is represented as a conservative and in many ways arguably has been very conservative on a number of issues, although it's kind of hard to know exactly what that word means in some of these issues, he has been dubbed the Green Pope because he's come right out and said, you know, climate change is real and this is an issue that we should all be dealing with. He has spoken out on behalf of labor unions, literally on behalf of labor unions, on protection for labor unions, things like the Wagner Act. He has spoken out in favor of eliminating world hunger through, and these are the Pope's words, not mine, wealth redistribution. He has called for the natural environment, nature, to be protected from us, from destruction, from predation. He has said, and again, I'm quoting Pope Benedict, "It is the moral responsibility of nations to guarantee access to health care to all of their citizens, regardless of social and economic status or their ability to pay." Justice in health care, the Pope said, should be a priority of governments and international institutions. And he has urged the Bush administration to treat immigrants with human dignity. So we'll see where it's fascinating. The Catholic Church has very often been at the forefront of positive social change. So a turning point, an interesting turning point. Meanwhile, after Michigan and Indiana passed right to work for less laws, now Mitch McConnell is apparently going to support Rand Paul in passing a national right to work for less law, which says that the union basically still has to represent you, but you don't have to pay union dues. You don't have to pay anything to the union. You can screw the union. And you can sue the union if they don't represent you the way you want. And therefore, the union dies. And with it dies the last vestige of what used to be called the American dream. Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. This is like just totally bizarre. So, but back to the Pope's suggestion that governments have moral obligations. As I pointed out earlier, money came out of community. It did not come out of trade. If you look at early societies, if you look at indigenous societies, Aboriginal societies, tribal societies, the concept of private property is actually fairly minimal. It's all about community property. And where there is, and people give into the community, take from the community. I mean, it's very Marxist. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. This is how most tribes function. And as people settled and became agricultural and just, you know, there was more of a need for governance specifically and provision for the commons, out of that came the need for some way for everybody to participate in funding that commons. And this is what led to the creation of money, not people needed a medium of exchange so that manufacturer A could buy parts from manufacturer B. It's a fantasy. Taxes are basically a shift in value from the private sector into the public sector. In other words, taxes are the way that we make sure that we can have our commons, that things can work. And the reason, arguably, why we have dollars is so we can have taxes. It's not a coincidence in my mind that Abe Lincoln created the greenback and created income taxes. I mean, how can you have taxes if you don't have a currency? And somehow that gets lost on everybody. It's like, oh, he created the currency, and then he decided to tax people. No, I have a feeling it was the other way around. He said, we need to collect taxes, but, you know, what good is the federal government is going to do the federal government to have New Hampshire script and Vermont script and Massachusetts script? And no, you know, or notes from this bank and that bank and this other bank. And, you know, that might work in communities, but no, it doesn't work at a national level. You have to have a national currency in order to be able to pay for national stuff. In this case, it took a real crisis to provoke that, you know, the Civil War. So deficits are the exact opposite. And by the way, there was a blog about this back in November of last year by Bunny Girl 60 over at Arliss Bunny over at the Daily Kos, titled Monetary Money, A Modern Monetary Theory Versus the Fiscal Cliff, where she comes right out and says the federal deficit is not big enough, number one. Why? Because if you look at history, you look at the past, you know, 60, 70 years of American history for which we have the numbers, what you find is that when the federal deficit goes up, so does the surplus of value in the private sector. When the federal deficit goes down, the surplus of value in the private sector goes down. In other words, it's not a coincidence that right now the stock market is so high, corporate profits are so high, and the federal debt is so high. There's a relationship between those two. It's double entry bookkeeping. It's the two sides of the ledger. Now, people say, well, but, you know, what about the fact that corporate profits are really high and wages are really low? Well, that's a whole separate thing. That has to do with you know, regulation of the economy, with which, to a large extent, is done by tax policy. By tax policy, you affect behavior. So we do taxes for two purposes. And in fact, the principal purpose is not to raise money to run the government. The principal purpose for tax policy is to modify the behavior of people operating within the society, which I think was lost on Reagan and his buddies. Because it used to be that, you know, the billionaires treated us fairly well until Reagan cut their taxes from 74% down to 28%. Oops.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And now, you know, the Walton family sitting around paying 15, well, now this year it went up to 20% top maximum capital gains rate, them and Mitt Romney. Oops. Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Here's the essential question. If, you know, you get into this whole thing about deficits being a way to leave value, to quote Bunny's blog, in the private sector, taxes a way to move value out of the private sector into the public sector, deficits is a way to make sure that the private sector has wealth. The federal government is not balancing a budget. It is balancing an economy. I mean, these are like just some concepts that just fly in the face of everything we've always learned or thought we knew about economics. But here's the biggest question. And this is why I said I think, you know, one of the things that really jazzes me the most about modern monetary theory is that one of their core tenets is to call for full employment and with the government as the employer of last resort, because you have to ask the question, if we have taxes and if we have currency, if we have money, as a consequence of the obligation that we all owe to society, to each other, to make society work, what is the obligation that society has to us? In other words, why do we have government? Why have government? Why have all this stuff? And the simple answer, I mean, again, you know, go back to the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's pretty straightforward stuff. And if that's the purpose of government, I mean, what you've got right now are Republicans behaving as if the purpose of government is to balance a budget. No, that's not the purpose of government. The purpose of government has to be to keep your debt to GDP ratio below 115%. No. And beyond that, that's a stupid way of looking at the math, because the 115% is the numerator, the top number on the decimal, and the bottom of the decimal is the 100, that 100%. If you want to change the ratio between the two, you don't just hack the numerator, you can increase the denominator, right? You can make the number on the bottom bigger, and relatively speaking, the number on the top gets smaller. In other words, if you want to cut the debt relative to GDP, grow the friggin' GDP. Well, how do you do that? You do that with government spending. And I don't, you know, what blows my mind are these people who say, World War II got us out of the Great Depression. And then you say, well, what was World War II if it wasn't a giant government spending program? I mean, come on. We have now, this, you know, some of these MMT people have gotten together and they've looked at the math on this. And you know, I mean, you've got 20 some odd million people who are unemployed or underemployed right now. That means that we are leaving on the table in terms of productive capacity in the United States, not to mention all the empty factories and whatnot, but just people. Tens of billions of man hours a year, $9 billion a day, $9.6 billion, according to Kathy, what's her name? I'll have to track this down. I want to get her on as a guest, but I'm lousy with names. We're looking at over $9 billion that we're just leaving on the table because we're not employing people. And instead, what are we doing? We are paying unemployment benefits to them. We're paying food stamps for people who are underemployed or who are unemployed. We're paying for their health care through Medicaid, when instead we could be giving them a job. We have bridges that are falling apart all over this country. We've got, you know, our broadband system, our internet infrastructure is rapidly becoming third worldish, in large part because of the monopoly of a half a dozen companies controlling it all and refusing to invest in it. If we simply said, you know, we're going to put fiber across the country, we're going to fix our bridges and roads, we're going to bring our water and sewer systems up to the 21st century, we're going to start building solar power systems, regional power systems, solar, wind, whatever may be appropriate to the region. They can be public, they can be public-private partnerships, they can even be something that eventually we're going to privatize. But we're going to use public money right now to do it. We're going to borrow and spend this money to do it, and we're going to put these people to work. And frankly, you don't even need to borrow and spend to do it. You can simply spend to do it, because where does the American dollar come from? America. We create it. We are the issuer of the currency. So why don't we simply take ourselves to full employment? Why not spend, you know, the last time we had full employment was the last year of the Clinton administration, and or the year, maybe the year before the last year of the Clinton administration, and it was because of a bubble. Let's do this more sensibly. Let's have a tax, but you know, this is Larry Beinhardt demonstrated, and this is not part of modern monetary theory, or maybe it is. I don't know. I mean, this is just, you know, my conversations with Larry Beinhardt over the years, that whenever taxes on the top marginal income rates, in other words, after you've made $1 million or $2 million or whatever, your tax, you know, that top rate, whenever that goes above 50%, we don't have bubbles. Because it changes people's behavior. Money is dear. It's expensive. And whenever the top tax rate is below 50%, we have bubbles. We've been having a series of bubble economies ever since Reagan took the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. And it's sitting right now at 20% for billionaires and 39% for the rest of us. It's still below 50%. pretty crazy when you think about it. So, net on this, bottom line on this, the purpose of government is to provide a decent life for all of us, to make sure that our lives are decent. If the private sector, if the private economy can't do that, it is the job of government to step in and do it. And what will happen is when government steps in to do it and puts people to work and those people spend the money, the cash register, the store that they spend that money in, they don't care if that money started as government money or as AT&T's money. They don't care. The economy gets stimulated.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The economy gets stimulated. The economy grows. The private sector grows. It starts hiring more and more people. And pretty soon you don't need the government stimulus anymore. Real simple. Very, very dipsedicously ugly, the good, the American people. Nearly 26,000 people have signed a petition on the White House's We the People page to fire Assistant U.S. Attorney Steve Heyman. Heyman was the lead attorney in the prosecution of Internet pioneer Aaron Schwartz, who tragically took his own life last month. Heyman has been accused of gross prosecutorial overreach and trying to turn Schwartz's case into a career booster. If convicted, Schwartz was looking at serving more time in jail than drug dealers, burglars, and even murderers. But this problem is bigger than just Heyman. The American justice system is broken and needs to be fixed. Let's hope that Aaron Schwartz didn't die in vain and that his death will be the catalyst of change that is desperately needed in our judicial system. The bad. Senator Lindsey Graham. On CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, the Republican senator threatened to place a hold on the national security nominations of Chuck Hagel and John Brennan until President Obama explains how the White House reacted to Benghazi attacks. Take a look.
I'm not sure I understand. What do you plan to do if they don't give you an answer? Are you going to put a hold on these two nominations?
Yes. I'm going to ask my colleagues, just like they did with John Bolton. Joe Biden said, no confirmation without information. No confirmation without information.
All right, so rather than put in place leaders who can help America prepare for the possibility of future terrorist attacks, Graham would rather continue to dwell on Benghazi. What's that they say about beating a dead horse? And the very, very ugly, the NRA. Speaking at the NRA's Wisconsin State Convention this weekend, a spokesperson for the organization said that the NRA will wait until the Connecticut effect, their word, has subsided to continue to push to block any and all forms of gun control. Lobbyist Bob Welch said, quote, "We have a strong agenda coming up for next year, but of course a lot of that's going to be delayed as the Connecticut effect has to go through the process." This just goes to show how deluded the NRA is. They view the tragedy in Connecticut not as a turning point in national discussions over gun control, but simply as something like the common cold, which comes on and eventually goes away. We can't let that be the case. Now is the time to act on gun control, because if we don't, the NRA will continue to spend millions to keep guns on our streets, threatening the lives of Americans everywhere, and that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay. Just a couple of more quick monetary points here that I want to make. And you know, some of this is getting really wonky. The public sector and private sector have to be in balance. So if you have debt in the public sector, that's government, there has to be a surplus in the private sector. And there is. I don't know if you've looked around. You know, look at the stock market. One of the points the bunny makes is blog over Daily Kos, Bunny Girl 60. Arliss Bunny, is when was the last time your foot had the flu? You don't get flu in your foot. You get it through your whole body. Similarly, economies are systemic. When an economy is in recession, the private sector is in recession, the public sector is in recession, everything is being affected by that recession. Everything has to participate in responding to that. to say, oh, we just need to wait for the public, for the private sector. This was Herbert Hoover's plan in 1929. He said, oh, you know, in fact, was it Andrew Mellon was his Secretary of Treasury, as I recall, said, you know, liquidate everything, liquidate labor, liquidate equity, liquidate, and he went through a list. Basically, in other words, let it all fall. And it will eventually resolve itself. Who was it? Andrew Mellon. Thank you very much. I knew it was that Mellon guy back in the 20s. You know, this is a billionaire banker. I mean, sort of like Hank Paulson, who got $500 million from Goldman Sachs. And then they actually had to change the rules so that he could sell it tax-free. They didn't have to. I mean, they did so he could join the cabinet. Man, $500 million. That was the going away gift. Anyhow, what constrains the ability to create money to just say, okay, we're going to increase, you know, the government's going to spend $2 trillion here and we're just going to create it? The three things that constrain it are inflation, exchange rates, and unemployment. And we don't have inflation. Our exchange rates are healthy. In fact, you could argue that if our exchange rates were to decline, in other words, if the dollar was to become worth less money relative to other currencies, that would actually help our trade deficit. In fact, it would help it rather dramatically. It would make imported things more expensive. It would make exported things less expensive. Boom. Good thing. And for the guy who called earlier and said, oh, you know, you're talking about inflation here. No, we're talking, you know, because he was talking about the prices of commodities in the United States. And I'm saying that's not inflation. That's the increase in prices of commodities. Yes, commodities are going up in price. But if inflation meant the debasement of our currency, then you wouldn't just see the price of commodities go up. You would see the value of the dollar relative to everything else on earth going down. And that's not happening. Although, you know, we could make that happen. But the three things that restrain it are inflation, exchange rates, and unemployment. In other words, we need to be spending government money to put people to work as the employer of last resort until we reach full employment. At that point, we stop. Because if you spend beyond that point, then you will have inflation. There's a natural barrier. This is balance sheet math. This is double entry bookkeeping. So anyhow, end of rant. We're gonna be doing modern monetary theory 101 here for the next, I don't know, year on this program. I mean, I just want to start digging into this stuff little by little and exposing you to some of the concepts as I'm learning them along with you in many cases. And so occasionally I'm gonna get things a little wrong, but I think I'm getting my hands around some of these concepts in a pretty solid way, and we're going to be getting guests on regularly and who can talk about these things in ways that make sense, because I believe that this is referred to as neo-Keynesianism, the new Keynesianism. This is because, you know, Keynes's theories worked great, but they worked great in a world where we were the sovereign issuer of our currency, but because of Bretton Woods, actually Bretton Woods came after, you know, Keynes was doing his thing, but you know, Bretton Woods is where 44 nations, I think, got together and 43 of them agreed to peg their value of their currency to the value of the dollar, and then we agreed that we would peg the value of the dollar to the value of gold. Okay, that was Bretton Woods. It's after World War II. And prior to that, we were, to a certain extent, we were pegging the value of our dollar to the value of gold, and thus all the gold and Fort Knox and all that, quack, quack, quack. Nixon took us off that in 71. It's a new world. So we need a new form of Keynesianism, a new economics. And this is it, modern monetary theory, in my mind. Not speaking for it, speaking of it. I'm not an economist. I'm a talk show host and a writer and whatever, but I want to learn this really well, and more importantly, I want you to learn this really well. As Dick Cheney famously said, deficits don't matter. What matters is unemployment. Now, Dick Cheney didn't say that, but that's the case. If you want Congress to be running around with their hair on fire, hysterical about something, putting something into a constitutional amendment, it should be unemployment. What's the purpose of government? You know, I said this before. Why do we have government? Do we have government so that we can balance our budget? No. You have government to make a society where you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other words, a society that works. How can a society work if you've got 20% functional unemployment? Or 17% or whatever U6 is. So you use government to bring about full employment, and then the system works. Ed in Springfield, Mass. Hey, Ed. Thanks for listening to WHMP. Hey. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Love your show.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. I'm calling because of that guest you had on earlier from the National Right to Work for Less Committee. And, you know, I've been listening to this argument all my life, it seems, but there's a new element I heard him say, and it's the second or third time I've heard this argument coming out of those folks. You pointed out, just to, you know, refresh people's recollection on how this went, you pointed out that, that the current law does not require anyone to join a union.
But it does require the union to represent people. I had to move it along here, Ed, because we just have a half a minute.
Okay, it does require the union to represent everybody in the bargaining unit equally, member and non-member alike. His rebut to that was that requirement for exclusive representation only comes about because the union demands it at the bargaining table. Factually not true under the law, a gross distortion of what the labor laws actually say. There's a name for such a scheme. It's called partial representation. And if you look at the legislative history of the Wagner Act, now called the National Labor Relations Act, that was an idea that was actually considered in 1935 and rejected by the Congress in favor of what it is today. I've negotiated more union contracts than I could count, even a fair number of first-time agreements where a group of workers first organized.
Right.
The union doesn't go to the bargaining table and demand exclusive representation.
Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Ed, last 10 seconds. There were words.
Anyone would.
Oh, okay. Oh, you were still talking. Okay. Ed, I thank you for the call. We'll have to continue this conversation. Welcome back. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to draw upon both your knowledge of Germany and history. If I'm not mistaken, at the end of the Second World War, as part of the Marshall Plan, our government did all that it could to revive the labor movement, the union movement in Germany, not just to help workers in Germany, but as a defense of democracy, because they didn't want corporate power, the rich and powerful, to have a monopoly on political power.
Yes, there were two things. There were two things that FDR and then Harry Truman FDR was all about, and Harry Truman actually helped make happen, that were written into the German Constitution, largely at the encouragement of the Truman administration, that Truman wanted to make law in the United States and was unsuccessful at doing. And the first was a national health care program. And the second was that any corporation that has more than 1,000 employees must have half of the members of its board of directors be representatives of labor who work in that company.
One other quick point, if I could. There's a petition going around to try to improve the wages for waitresses.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I can't remember who it's brought forward by. But, you know, waitresses like in this state, and I know a lot of them because of my delivery job, they only get $2.78 an hour, $2.73 an hour. This is an absolute abomination.
Yep,
so
I agree.
Anybody out there listening, try to find that petition and sign it and make noise about it.
And let me tell you our experience. When I lived in Portland, Oregon, I believe it was the city, not the state, but the city passed a law saying that waitresses and waiters had to make minimum wage, which in Oregon is like, you know, more than the rest of the country. It's like $8-$9, something like that, and change. They had to make minimum wage plus tips. And all the restaurant companies said, oh, you know, this is going to be the end of the world. We're going to go out of business. We're going to have to double our food prices. They said, city fathers said, tough. We're going to do it anyway. They passed it. And what happens? Now you've got waiters. It actually stimulated the economy because waiters and waitresses are now making enough money that they can buy a little bit more at the local stores and have a little more decent life. And Portland, Oregon's sense of community and economy got stronger. it was a good thing. Matt, thanks for the call. I'm totally with you. This is a really important step. Stuart in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Stuart, you think this modern monetary theory stuff won't work. Why?
I think it won't work because there's this assumption of this group called we that does not exist. Every time you or your listeners hear that word we, I want them to ask, who is this we and who is it that controls our country?
So you're taking the libertarian position that there is no society, there's only a group of individuals?
No, not okay. That at all.
Are you suggesting that we have that our government has been corrupted to the point that there's no more small d democracy?
You said that a minute ago. Our politicians are lock, stock, and barrel, owned by the wealthy few, and so they control
the
government.
Not all of them, but many of them.
We conflate a government controlled by the powerful few with you and I.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not controlled by you and I.
Okay, so here's the question, Stuart. What are you going to do about it?
Well, it's a tough problem.
No, it's not. You know who the most powerful people in politics are in the United States? It's not the president. It's not senators. It's not state representatives or U.S. congressmen or women or whatever, any of that. It is precinct committee people.
You say it's precinct. I got involved with the Democratic Party here. They're all a bunch of sellouts.
Then you need to change that. They're all.
Get
a bunch of your friends and take over the local party.
They're too far gone, too far gone. I went in there. I tried to talk some sense to people, tried to get them to look critically at our Democratic Party, look critically at our president, nobody wants to hear any of it. And, you know, you get a group where you're the one in 200, and it's just too difficult to try to change that group.
Stuart, I'm sorry that it's just too hard for you to work to make democracy work. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm still willing to fight for it. Gene in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's up? Gene, you're on the air. Gene is not on the air. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Oh, hi, I'm on the air.
You're on the air, definitely.
Maybe this is a simple answer that I don't know. But if you go back to a gold standard, how do you increase the money supply for, you know, more people growing? If you have a stagnant, say they stop.
You have to get more gold. And that was the problem that Nixon confronted. And that's why he took us off the gold standard.
So in other words, we would have like if gold all is found and it's all in possession of governments, then as we got more people, as we have more and more population, everybody would have to fight for the X amount of gold there is there.
Right.
You can't have a gold standard, right?
And in fact, what had happened was we were at the time that Nixon closed the gold window, we were exchanging dollars for, you know, 25% of the value of a dollar was gold. So what you do is over time you continuously have to devalue the amount of gold or reduce the amount of gold that you will exchange your dollars for, because the dollars are effectively becoming a fiat currency. That is to say, they're reflecting the total economic activity of the economy more than they are the amount of gold you have in Fort Knox. And at a certain point, and I would argue that point is easily 50%, but at a certain point you have to say this is stupid. There's no point to having the gold. Instead, we should simply be saying this money is a fiat currency. This money, it represents the net wealth of the entire nation. It is us. It represents us as society and, you know, pure and simple. And then you ask the question out of that. If money represents, you know, if money is brought into being by society, what is or we the people, a government, whatever, then what is the goal? What is the job of we the people? The job of we the people is to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I would say the first job of government is to make sure that anybody who wants to work can work, that our productive capacity is at 100% or damn close to it, that we're using the productivity that we have. We have this huge amount of productivity that we're not using. And so, anyhow, Richard, thank you for the call. Interesting point. We will continue with our MMT ongoing seminar. And bits and pieces. Plus, tomorrow the president delivers his first State of the Union speech of his second term, his fifth actual space State of the Union speech. What do you want to hear? And we'll have a preview. Plus, some presidents think the president should be channeling LBJ. I'll have a conversation with Tim Carpenter, PD America, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. By the way, to our friend in Seattle, you want to get involved? Go to pdamerica.org. You can get involved without getting inside the Democratic Party. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.